Aren't you a technology supplier looking for deal flow? Then you should try our new platform, Connect. It's designed to help buyers and brands find the best tech solutions to match their campaign requirements. It's free for buyers to use and for tech suppliers to set up an account and start applying to campaign briefs. Set up your account today by visiting exchangewire.com/connect or email us at info@thewirecorp.com.
The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast. I'm Matt Broughton, Senior Editor at ExchangeWire, and I'm delighted to be joined by two of ExchangeWire's finest today. Firstly, we've got Lindsay Rowntree, Head of Content at ExchangeWire, if I can say that correctly. Hello, Lindsay.
Hello, finest. What an introduction. Thank you, Matt.
And we've got Anne-Marie Sheedy, Global Head of Partnerships at ExchangeWire. Anne-Marie, how are you?
Hello, I'm very well. Hello, everyone.
Awesome. I'm delighted to also announce that today has been a return to normality in the United Kingdom, given that I was supposed to go into the office today, but the railway system decided that no, that was not going to happen. So the joys of commuting are returning at last. Hooray.
But for a good reason, though, there were trespassers on your line. So
yes, it wasn't a shortage of drivers, which
at least humans are still being human and doing stupid things like trespassing on train lines.
Exactly. Kicking off into our first news story of the week, Southeast Asian super app Grab is going public in the US via a reverse merger with Altimeter Group Corp, SPAC. The deal will give Grab an equity value of close to $40 billion, the largest SPAC-led listing on record, making the Singaporean firm the most valuable Southeast Asia-based company to trade in the US, despite it not yet turning a profit. Now, Grab began as a ride-hailing platform before transforming into a so-called super app that now provides services ranging from food delivery to e-commerce logistics and beyond. As noted by Axios, some apps are yet to crack the US market, while they have been thriving in APAC marketplaces due to a mobile-focused environment. Now, for a bit of financial context, SPACs, or special purpose acquisition companies, are publicly listed shell companies typically backed by investment groups, which are specifically formed for the purpose of acquiring established companies and taking them public, which sort of subverts the traditional IPO process, which sometimes has been deemed as lengthy or costly for such companies. Often when going public via an SPAC, a firm will raise money via private investment in public equity or PIPE transaction, as Grab has done here, nabbing $4.5 billion in the process. Now, the move to go public via an SPAC is puzzling to some who say that Grab would have had more success by pursuing a traditional IPO, particularly considering that global financial authorities have become increasingly wary of SPACs. So a few things to unpick here in terms of whether the SPAC trend will continue and in terms of the super app trend itself. So my first question to you guys is, are you surprised by the size of this deal? And do you think this could be the beginning for super apps in the United States? Anne-Marie, let's start with you.
Am I surprised by the deal? No, not really. I think Grab is a fantastic organisation. They started 10 years ago as a ride-hail platform. Some might describe them as the kind of Singapore version of Uber, but they really quickly developed into a super app or a comprehensive digital wallet, shall we say. So providing, like you said, everything from food delivery to financial services. What did surprise me was Axios and their comment about its popularity in Southeast Asia is driven in part by slower mobile broadband speeds, which, you know, discourage people from downloading multiple apps, let alone kind of running them simultaneously. I just thought, Jesus, that's just shocking. Are you completely stuck in your own bubble? Because as a business, it's where the future is, I think. So really, it hasn't surprised me at all in that regard.
Awesome. Lindsay?
Yeah, I think further to Anne-Marie's point, it was an interesting turn of phrase that Axios used, sort of saying that basically because Southeast Asia, they have really poor broadband, they use one app that allows them to do multiple things rather than run multiple apps because they can't afford to download them and use them simultaneously. And while there is obviously truth to that, I would then argue that is what has spurred this rise in super apps. But and you know, I say this quite a lot, but necessity is the mother of invention in that regard. But actually, what we've noticed, and we talked about a lot in the MarTech podcast, is that the benefits of these super apps go far beyond there being, you know, the APAC being a mobile first environment, Southeast Asia being a mobile first environment. And they cater to what a consumer wants, whether that consumer, you know, we are all mobile first now. You can't tell me that the US isn't if not mobile first, becoming mobile first. So why in Europe, why in North America, why wouldn't we also take advantage of the kind of the super app trends that are happening? And I think that's a really interesting thing. And I think that the Grab going public in the US could spark the rise of super apps in the US. I don't know if the US believes that. I also feel like there should be more traction with these kind of super apps in, outside of those areas too. Viber is another example that's very, very popular in not just Southeast Asia, but Eastern Europe and LATAM as well. Again, for similar reasons, but we need to look beyond the reason that these super apps exist, just being that they have rubbish broadband and they all use their mobiles and they can't afford laptops or can't afford computers, because it's not, like I said, while there's an element of truth to it, it's not the be all and end all of why those super apps are so popular and famous. Famous, well, sure. Yeah, they are famous, I guess. But I think that the interesting thing for me is, well, first of all, you say SPAC, I say SPAC. I wonder if there is a what the correct is. So I'm now going to start calling them SPACs because I didn't. Yeah. Anyway, the SPAC thing is interesting. I'll admit to not knowing a huge amount about SPACs because I'm not particularly financially minded when it comes to anything stocks and shares related. But what was interested me was, you know, why would Grab go down the SPAC route rather than the traditional IPO route? And kind of looking into it, you know, there's a lot of different reasons for it. SPACs allow you to kind of get to market more quickly. And they also allow you, if you don't have operations in a particular market, to get into that market more easily as well. And the interesting thing about Altimeter is that they already are investors in many other companies, including some Asian companies as well. For example, Expedia, Snowflake, Pinduoduo, which is Chinese e-commerce platform, Alibaba, Facebook, Uber. So if you need expertise, local market expertise that you haven't got because you don't operate in that market, I think Altimeter, you know, will provide you that. I was reading as well that, you know, the beauty of a SPAC is that you are able to attract retail investors. But given that the SPAC is only $500 million versus the valuation of like $40 billion, it's a very, very small amount to offer to retail investors. And actually, the bulk of it is still going to the larger financial investors. So actually, there probably isn't a big reason, like a Grab particularly fussed about allowing, you know, the likes of you and me to invest in them. Probably not. But it's a good, interesting way. And we've seen a massive surge in SPACs, obviously, particularly in the tech world. And I think we'll continue to. There's a lot of kind of questioning about whether they are the right move and if they're particularly safe. And, you know, if those kind of companies will go bust more quickly than IPOs. But then there are plenty of disastrous IPOs as well. So I think it's really interesting. I think that Grab need this. Grab need to do this because Grab need more financial leverage. They need more capital. There's a lot of competition in that area, particularly in Southeast Asia. You know, we saw the merger of Gojek and Tokopedia, so now being called GoTo, and Gojek is a massive competitor of Grab's over in Southeast Asia, the Indonesian company, and also C Group that are, I think, gaming and finance first, that are moving into food delivery as well, based out in Indonesia as well, I believe, and they are like gaining momentum. So Grab need the capital, and this is an interesting way of doing it.
I also think it's interesting because, from my limited understanding, I must admit, is that through a SPAC, companies can offer more attractive compensation packages to key employees and a valuable kind of non-cash currency for financing acquisitions. So in addition to investors having benefited from SPACs as well, the common one being the ability to kind of redeem shares back at the IPO price. And SPACs also come with a time limit to get a deal done, which gives investors a shortened horizon for a possible upside. So if you think about going public through a SPAC, it can accelerate a company's market entry by anywhere between 2 and 4 months. So without a company in the actual shell, there are fewer SEC comments and questions to kind of answer, given the lack of financial statements and related materials, but the auditing process is shortened. So that's probably an upside as well. But also, you've got the added assurance of having a long-term investor base via private investment in public equity, or PIPE, I believe it's known as. So that's in place instead of trying to sell a company to public investors or get a roadshow. So I think it's a combination of what you were saying, Lindsay, and maybe some of those factors that perhaps make it appealing and perhaps why it's people are going to look at it more long term. No idea when it comes to kind of judicial things or various marketplaces what the implications may be. But from a kind of top line bird's eye view of that, they're all very compelling factors to kind of go with SPAC.
Yeah, I think in terms of SPAC, as I shall call them, I don't know, no idea whether that is
the two guns, correct.
Matt. Exactly. They do offer the investors that flexibility. And I think where, you know, investors who are looking to exit a company or founders who are looking to exit a company, they've traditionally just had the two routes of either an IPO, which has its drawbacks, you know, looking sort of Lindsay flagged in terms of traditional IPOs not necessarily having the best of times. Deliveroo is a prime recent example of that, I think. Either that or it's just constantly raising venture capital and, you know, there are limits in how much you can grow a company when you're getting to that sort of Series G, Series H stage. So they do, you know, they do offer investors that flexibility. But I think the kind of regulatory concerns, which admittedly I haven't looked into too much either, I think that just kind of stems from a sort of hesitancy about shell companies in general, given that previously they haven't necessarily been used for the best of purposes. That's sort of my opinion of it.
Yeah, I think your question about, you know, whether it'll catch on or... I'd like to think so. I mean, if you look at WeChat or Alipay in China, Line in Japan and Grab and Gojek, like you said, Gojek and Tokopedia, two of India's biggest internet companies, they're finalizing, what, 18 billion merger?
Yeah.
Another giant, you know, and it's just, I just feel that, and sometimes we're guilty, or maybe we're fortunate that we're in between the US and APAC, that we and have got an appetite for such information. But I think I feel that it's kind of what every big tech player or fintech player would like to be doing. Just because the likes of Google and Amazon or Apple may not be talking about it, but I definitely believe that's what they kind of aspire to be. Because every new function or feature or acquisition and platform extension is literally another attempt to add another layer of functionality to capture more of the consumer's time and attention and spend. So if you think about, you know, there's something ridiculous coming out from Facebook, I think, in terms of some new dating app called Sparks.
A bit
experimental that will allow users to enroll with their Facebook profiles. They're positioning it as some sort of free platform. But, you know, it's another play for them to get people using their app and keep them in there. They're also, I think, launching something called Hotline, which is a web-based application that's something of a mashup between Instagram Live and Clubhouse. So they're all desperately trying to find other ways to keep us in their app and develop them out as a super app. Because if you think about, well, what do we use on a daily basis? How many apps have we got on our phone? How many are you jumping for? Yes, I'm relatively organized and have them set up in travel folders or admin folders or finance folders. But I'd certainly be happy if there was just one app that I could check my electricity bill with, pay for something, look at eventually, again, when we return to normal, booking a table for eating out, booking my travel, booking a hotel, shopping, and having it all in one place just makes absolutely perfect sense to me.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of, you know, the crux of the question where, you know, they are demonstrable cases of them in APAC. Why haven't there necessarily been them in Western markets yet? Because, as you said, there is that appetite for a one-stop shop. Why hasn't that been the case yet?
I guess again, it's like I was saying earlier, it's because there hasn't needed to be. So the companies in our markets haven't needed to try to get into, you know, we have a lot of legacy systems over here, particularly when it comes to payment, which is changing, but still not changing very, very quickly, versus Southeast Asia, where they aren't reliant on things like credit cards. They are able to be more innovative when it comes to different sort of payment methodologies and payment solutions. But outside of that, there's less fewer restrictions around how companies can operate and what they can bring together in one place. And I guess from a regulatory perspective, the governments have been able to reduce those regulations to allow these things to happen to make it easier for their consumers. Well, because we haven't needed to historically haven't needed that, and we do have a legacy system in place, and the regulation isn't there to try to kind of make them more interoperable. There's just been no desire for it. I think from a consumer perspective, the desire is absolutely there. Like Anne-Marie said, I would love to have this the kind of one-stop shop where I can do everything and handle everything. I don't understand who wouldn't really.
Until it gets hacked.
That's very true. That is a problem. We are more data sensitive over here as well, far more data sensitive. So we need to think about that. But I think, you know, if you could find those solutions and the regulations were reduced to make it happen, that would be interesting.
Absolutely. Sort of tying in nicely to that in terms of data sensitivity on our next topic. Some consumers are experimenting with selling their streaming service login details online. A survey of 1,000 adults conducted by Redpoints has found that 40% of respondents have sold their streaming logging information, with 66% of 18 to 30-year-olds admitting to having purchased someone else's details. Social media platforms prove the most popular location for these exchanges, with around 70% of sellers using them to flog their details. E-commerce sites, online marketplaces, and encrypted messaging services also proved commonplace for such transactions. Password sharing has become a matter of growing concern for the premium streamers and is estimated to cost SVODs $25 billion every year. Now, Netflix, which is estimated to lose about $6 billion a year from the practice, has announced their determination to stamp out this account sharing by introducing measures to limit accounts to a single household. Yet many remain doubtful that the issue can be tackled so easily and wonder how feasible it would be for Netflix and other streamers to police their users' details. So my first question to you guys is, are you surprised that selling login details has become a bit of a trend? What does it also say about how consumers value their personal and sensitive data, such as login information, particularly in an age where we're supposedly all increasingly concerned about our own privacy? Lindsay, let's start with you.
I did not know this was a thing. Like, it's a freaking brilliant business idea. I should have thought of it myself. I didn't know that people, the young folk were doing this. Matt,
the young folk, yeah. You need to get down with the kids. Come on,
Matt. As a young folk, are you doing
as a young folk/youth? I had no idea that passwords were being sold.
It's interesting, isn't it? But I think that obviously it's interesting from a data sensitivity perspective, and it does say a lot. We were just talking, as you said, about data sensitivity and the fact that these markets were more data sensitive. I wasn't clear on where these stats come from. I'm assuming they came from the US, where, you know, we couldn't possibly have a super app because we don't like sharing all our data in one place. But again, this probably speaks something generationally. Maybe the young folk are more open to that because they're more understanding about, you know, how the data is being used, or maybe they aren't, and maybe they operate more in a way that they do maybe in like the China, where they understand the value exchange. They know if they give their data away, they know what they're getting back in return. Maybe there is that understanding there to a certain degree. So they just kind of are happy to, you know, if I will give my data away if I get money, in which case, you know, can Netflix et al. Capitalize on that somehow? Like, well, obviously they are, as a subscriber, I'm giving my data to you for money in the first place. Like, they're not just getting money for producing shows, they're getting my personal information and my data. So it makes a lot of sense. But I think as well, for me, it's interesting. Obviously, these streaming platforms are losing a lot of revenue. Like, there were 1,000 people that were surveyed, 40% admitted to having sold their login details to others, like 66% admitted to having bought login details. But of those, like, you know, 40% is 400 people just in this subset alone. That's, you know, from Netflix, like $10,000 in revenue from the 1,000, they could have got another 400 subscribers off the back of it from the 400 that have sold the details onto at least one person. It could be between 4,000, 16,000 extra revenue just from that 1,000 people. So it actually represents a lot of extra revenue that these streaming platforms are missing out on. But I think the most interesting thing is, you know, in a world where we're talking a lot about first party data and, you know, having to kind of be in control of our data and logged in data, how is this affecting how they are targeting and their algorithms and how they are kind of working with where they are, where there are hybrid models or where there are models such as, you know, maybe from Netflix perspective, product placement? How is the lack of understanding of who is watching and what we know about the person that's paying for the platform and watching the content? content. How is that affecting how brands are able to engage in VOD, in CTV, how they're able to kind of to purchase, how they're able to measure? And, you know, is it costing them more to acquire a customer because they believe they're buying one thing and they're actually buying something else? And that's what I think for me is the most interesting thing.
Yeah, I mean, I will admit, I wasn't aware that people were selling it and that it was a trend. I do have a friend that, just the one. Well, I'm pushing it, I hope so, that barters, shall we say, certain login details with perhaps one service in exchange for login details for another service. So there's a value exchange there.
Clever.
I think from my understanding, this friend, there's an element of trust. So when they perhaps first logged into one of these services, they could see financial detail, perhaps shopping history, but there was...
Exactly.
There was an understanding that that would never be looked at again. And a joke about, no, I won't buy anything on the credit card that's attached to that, no problem. And then in return, it's going to go, well, what are you going to do with the information that you're receiving from your other friend? It's perhaps depending on the service that they've bought it on. It there's less risk. But are they going to actually, how is that data going to be abused? I think it depends on the service and what you're looking at. But then on the flip side of that, when you talk about Netflix as a prime example of who are keen to kind of stamp out the practice and how much they're estimated to lose, what about, you know, the 37 million new subscribers they had in 2020, you know, and the 200 million around the world? They increased their prices during lockdown in the UK anyway. I can't speak for other markets. They had massive hits such as Tiger King and The Queen's Gambit that reported, I think, something 18 billion in revenue and almost 2 billion in profit. That's sterling, so $25 billion, $2.8 billion. Now, am I going to feel sorry for them? No, not really, is my honest kind of approach. So I think it's about looking at where do we go next? What's the next phase, or the data police, I think, that you talked about, Matt? Are they, you know, it's all about value. And I think there's an element of greed. And also it goes back to subscription fatigue, which we've talked about on this podcast numerous times. How much money are you willing to spend, and what are you getting in return for it? The selling element, I don't know how that's going to work. So if I went and I sold my details, what's stopping me a month later? I create a fake account, I sell it, give them the details, someone's happily watching or using the service, and then I go in and I change my login details. So that's probably where the real money's been made, scamming in that regard. Or maybe I've just come up with a really interesting idea.
I think you might have, actually.
She's going to join the youth.
Yeah.
I think you raise a good point in that it's only going to get more commonplace as more and more streaming platforms pop up out of the woodwork. And I think, you know, with some of these newer ones that are on the market, which don't necessarily have the same level of content, is it going to be a case where people are going to subscribe to them, watch the one or two things that they actually want to watch, and then go, right, rather than faff around trying to delete these accounts, why not, you know, if I know a friend who wants to watch one or two other shows, and it's a case of, you know, how are the, you know, streaming platforms going to be able to crack down on that kind of activity where it is a, you know, a friend of a friend type scenario?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. I just feel there's so many platforms are already there with their own exclusive content, which means multiple subscriptions are required to watch kind of fragmented range of shows. For me, previously Sky used to be the kind of closest one thing to like a one-stop shop, but that's changed. And the frustrating thing is competition hasn't really helped pricing either. So what am I going to do? I'm going to have Sky, Netflix. I think, okay, there's a deal between the two of them. If you return or you're a new customer, but then you've got Disney Plus, you've got Apple, you've got Spotify, you've got HBO, you've got Amazon, you've got BritBox, where, you know, suddenly I think, how much am I paying for what? And how much am I actually watching in return? So yeah, of course, if I can kind of get a return, I might do that. I personally wouldn't, but I can understand why, if there are individuals out there, and there always are, they're going to try and take an advantage of a certain situation. It might be younger people that have, in the past year, found it even harder financially. They've been out of work or they're students and life is very difficult, and how they've been occupying themselves when they're in lockdown, and they have smashed through everything on Netflix but don't necessarily have the money to sign up to Disney Plus or Amazon Prime, but their friend does, or they know that actually if they sell access, then that will afford them the opportunity to kind of access content somewhere else. Don't know.
Yeah, I think the examples you've given are the UK as well. Like this, we're nothing compared to the US, where there's about 40 yeah. different skinny bundles, and a lot of them have the same content, and you don't really know where you're going to find each show. So you might have access to 10 different things, and there'd be one show that appears on four of them, but you don't know which one's showing the next episode and which one hasn't shown it yet. And it's all very, very complicated, you know, made more complicated by just new ones introducing themselves each time. And, you know, Disney Plus has now made massive waves, and they reckon that'll be the biggest streaming platform by 2024, which is insane, really. But given how they're churning out content, a lot of it, you know, not necessarily much original content yet, but, you know, Netflix started in the same way. You know, there's no reason why they can't take the mantle as being the biggest streaming platform, but we still have the challenge of there being so many different kind of miniature ultra channel by channel. You know, over here it's more kind of, over here it's BVOD, over there it's BVOD as well, but you have to pay kind of a monthly fee rather than paying. It's all very, very complicated and complex. And I totally agree, AMS, that there is you know, who's going to pay for all those things. But at the same time, The reason that it's able to exist is because those people were probably paying $200 a month for cable anyway at some point, and this is probably still cheaper than what they used to pay just to access kind of your normal TV that existed in the US in the first place.
Yeah, and I do. I mean, in one regard, how will Netflix continue to spend the monies that they have been, like last year, $17.3 billion on original content? And I think they're going to plan on spending even more this year. So the fact that people actually like the original content is a good thing for the company, given how much they spend on it. They also need customers to stay subscribed longer if they are to kind of retain competitive advantage in this space. I think they've already lost a considerable amount of the market share in the streaming business. So they need some point of differentiation in order for them to kind of remain top of the rankings, which I think, according to, I think it was the Wall Street 2021 streaming survey, that they hold top spot, followed by Amazon Prime Video with 12%, Disney Plus, Hulu and HBO Max then follow with about 67%. But US, again, the average household, they have what they say is 2.5 subscriptions to streaming services.
Yep.
But then how does that compare to the hundreds of dollars that they were spending on cable?
Well, exactly. That's the thing.
Yeah. Do you think, sort of, one point I wanted to kind of raise on this one is, do you think that, you know, given the parallels with kind of the display market at the moment, where we're seeing all the kind of mini walled gardens spring up, do you think that there's going to be a similar thing happen in that market, where consumers will be willing to sell their login information for a particular subscription service? Or, you know, and, you know, should ad tech be looking at that as, okay, we need to get some providers and a framework in to facilitate that?
Maybe, or to flip it around on that point as well, you might get kind of almost a sort of single sign-on service where access to one thing gives you access to multiple different platforms. And that might be the future. So someone somewhere will create a kind of, I guess, a democratized walled garden with multiple streaming platforms to have access to, a bit like what you know we're seeing with publisher consortium, that kind of along that kind of route, to enable. Sky is sort of doing it to a degree. Like, you can now, if you are in the UK, if you're a Sky customer, you can actually have your Disney Plus, Amazon Prime, Netflix accounts as apps all within your Sky logins, and you just kind of instantly access them, and you can pay for them through Sky as well if you want to. And I do think I see a bit more of that coming along, and that will kind of almost discourage. You can get discounts for it as well. So that might discourage me having a login to 10 different things and selling on those logins to other people if I have it all in one place. And then I can't share a login because my login is democratized to this one single sign-on thing in the first place.
Do you think it's going to be an element of trained behavior, though, where you don't want to miss out on the party because someone's watching something or getting access to something, therefore you want to be part of the chat? Because if you think about another viewpoint could be that, are we getting to the point where content is so diffused across so many streaming services, you're better off just buying what you want from an iTunes or something, or wherever, when you want it, and you're not subscribing to any of these, so you're saving that outgoings. But then also there could be something whereby, almost like panel-based from a tech perspective as well, that if I do choose to, going back to bartering perhaps, I will give you X amount of information on me. I will answer X amount of surveys. I will tell you, I will rate the adverts that you're showing me for a period of time, and I'll give you my viewpoints on them. And then they can use that information and sell that on as a kind of value exchange. That could be an option. But then there's also the whole product placement stuff as well, and what we're doing and how you've got the e-commerce element where we're going to be able to interact. And if I see somebody wearing, I don't know, Game of Thrones, I've never seen it, it's probably a bad example, but if they're drinking some sort of beverage, or they're wearing something that I like, will I be able to click on that and buy it instantly? What's the kind of return there as well? Or if I buy so much, a bit like Nectar points or something, if I spend so much and they can see so much, I'll start getting discounts on other services or other products. I think that's something that should be looked at.
Yeah, T-commerce. And we are, as it's technically referred to, TV commerce, obviously. And obviously we're sort of seeing that.
But that's going to be up for debate, isn't it, Lindsay? Because is it TV?
Well, of course it will be. At the moment, if you have to name it something, it is the most logical thing to name it at this stage, because it exists in many forms. But also, you know, if you look at China, I think it is Pinduoduo, who we talked about earlier, as being invested by Altimeter, but they're already from a video e-commerce platform, so I can watch a video of someone and I can buy what they're wearing instantly and click on it and buy it. And it's merging, and you know, the likes of TikTok are looking into similar things, right? It's merging that technology from kind of the social media platform into something that I can watch my favorite TV show, and I love the dress that person's wearing, so I want to buy it. And there's the coming together of the two of them. But it becomes very complicated, and that ties back into the kind of the data privacy aspect of it, because then who owns the payment information? If I'm able to just click and buy something, who is that being transacted by, and who has that payment? Who has my details, and how can that be shared? And that's where I think it's still becoming very complicated. But I think that that's definitely the way we're going.
Absolutely. Continuing on a similar theme in terms of personal data, our third and final news story of the week, China will ban apps from collecting excessive personal data from users from the 1st of May. Formerly a common practice within the country, developers will soon no longer be permitted to force users to disclose sensitive information such as financial and biometric details in order to access their services where it is deemed not appropriate. The move was announced last month with the publication of a document from four of the country's major regulators. While the change sounds dramatic, there haven't been any details regarding how the new rules will be enforced as yet, nor the penalties that developers will face if they disobey such rulings. The move will also potentially compound domestic tech companies' fall from grace with the Chinese authorities, with national titans such as Tencent and Alibaba now finding themselves under increasing governmental scrutiny. The ruling Chinese Communist Party imposed tighter restrictions relating to data collection last December, as well as new antitrust laws to curtail the country's platform economy, and have also derided Alibaba and Tencent as anti-competitive following Ant Group's disastrous IPO attempts. More curiously, however, is that the move comes as the state-backed China Advertising Association is leading efforts to bypass Apple's new ATT framework with their workaround CAID. With this in mind, one might reason that this move may not be truly based on user privacy. My first question to you guys is, what impact could this move have on app developers and tech firms based in China? Anne-Marie, let's start with you.
Oh, great. Thanks, Matt. I think until now, many developers have been denying users core app functionalities unless they agree to collect or a collection of some sort of personal data. It's been fairly extensive, as far as I'm aware, which is often kind of entirely unrelated to the app's function. So take, for example, a navigation app seeking to collect face biometrics. As of May 1st, that will no longer be legal. It's a tough one. I mean, because for me, data is now the most valuable resource in the world. It's not oil anymore. And how is it going to affect what the developers do in country? It's tricky. I mean, you talked at the beginning about excessive personal data? What is excessive? Because there's increased advances in technology. The collection of personal information has been extended to all sorts of information, biological information such as, you know, an individual's face or even genes, which could result in serious consequences if that information is misused. So there needs to be some sort of element of responsibility. My understanding is that it's kind of common practice in China where apps ask users to provide sensitive personal information, and those who refuse to share are often denied access. So while some requests are reasonable, such as going back to the location, if information on your location to use a navigation app, fine. Others are a bit unnecessary. So I think it would be good. I think there needs to be kind of some limitation and some control. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. Lindsay, what do you think on that one?
Yeah, I think I agree. I think that there are 30, it's a lot of it is logic. Like, logically, if I am not a location, if I'm not a ride hailing app, why do I need to know where you're located? Why do I need to know? So it's actually for me to have full use of the app, or for you to get what you want out of it, what information do I actually need? And that's what I think the questions aren't being asked. But the government have released a list of 39 different things, and you have to. So if you're this type of app, you can ask this information. If you're this type of app, you can ask that information. Mm-hmm. And again, it's logic based on, well, obviously, if you're a payment app, you're going to need their payment information. You're going to need their identity, for example. And in China, identity constitutes a mobile number, you know, as it sort of does over here as well, to a degree. And I think that it's interesting. But for me, the big thing here is, you know, you raise the point, Matt, that you know, this is contradicting that the CAID, which is you know, from the CAA backed by the Chinese government, and you know, do they actually care about Chinese? Do the Chinese care about data privacy after all? No, they care about control. And why? They're you know, we're seeing with the likes of Alibaba and Tencent, we're seeing that these kind of darling Chinese companies that were kind of front and center with the Chinese Communist Party. You know, getting in trouble, you know, Jack Ma, what the hell's happened to him, kind of with the disastrous Ant IPO? Like, it's there are strange things happening there at the moment. I think that the Chinese government is realizing they do not want any one app to have more data on a person than they have themselves. They want to be the rulers and the controllers of what personal data that they have, and they don't want apps to be usurping that power. And the big tech companies in China have been doing just that. And that is why I believe that they're curtailing this now, to stop those apps taking over too much control, which they believe they should hold themselves.
I think you're bang on there, Lindsay, because if you think about Chinese tech companies, investments abroad are vulnerable to national security investigations by foreign regulators.
Yeah.
So that will scare the bejesus out of them. You know what I mean? If you think the Chinese tech companies are faced with what could be described maybe deep versus broad dilemma. So the deep ties with Chinese government help promote their domestic business, but jeopardize their international expansion. And ultimately they want to control everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think from my perspective, if the Chinese government was so concerned about personal data, they wouldn't have implemented a real name identification system in video games at the end of last year. Which was ostensibly to protect the country's youth, but at the same time, it basically negated one of the few remaining channels where people could anonymously comment on the actions of their government in the country there. So it's if they were that concerned about personal data, then, you know, they wouldn't necessarily have done that.
No, exactly, and the CAID thing just confirms that even more. Obviously, they don't want Apple to be the controlling force behind data privacy. So by implementing CAID, the government still has that control, and Apple doesn't. They're not going to, you know, if Apple start going, well, we will just stop those apps existing on the App Store, they won't do that, because there's too many ties, and they seem to be turning a blind eye to CID by all accounts. So I don't see that Apple are that concerned by it, but I think that, you know, China want to be the ones to be seen to be controlling their own country's data privacy. They don't want an American tech company to be doing that. They don't want a Chinese tech company to be doing it, let alone an American tech company. So they're happy for data to be used, but only as long as they have the control over it. And you know, maybe COVID's had a lot to do with this, because obviously China implemented some very, very strict rulings about, you know, they very, very strict controls over their citizens during the pandemic, particularly kind of for them sort of between January and June last year. And they were using a lot of data to be able to work out what someone's temperature was, work out where they could and couldn't go. If they got to a place they weren't allowed to go, they have a big red cross come up on their phone. Like, there was a lot that China could do with the data of their citizens last year. And they want to make sure they still have control of that, and probably COVID's made them realize that even more.
Yeah, and perhaps even on top of that, if you think about how vital data is, not just for its kind of economic value, but also for its growing influence in politics. It won't surprise me that they're sitting back and looking at, oh, the Cambridge Analytica fiasco, and then our own fiasco here with regards to the Brexit referendum. Well, what's to say, I think, is it 2023? I think they'll have another election in China. They're probably all over that. So that the apps within China will no longer be permitted to force users into accepting excessive data collection, because they won't want that being misused or hacked, or they'll just want the control, and it probably will be collected, but they'll have ownership over it.
Do you think there's going to be a kind of difference between the implementation of the rules on domestic and international firms, or do you think it's just a case of, no, we're blanket banning on data? Not blanket banning, but restriction.
There'll be deals to be done, probably.
Good question. Yeah, I wonder that.
There's probably some under-the-table activity that will happen if the money's right.
But as it stands, it's always hard for non-Chinese companies to operate in China anyway. So yes, wonder, yeah, I think that there's going to be some conversation to be had over if you're a Chinese company versus not. Because like you said at the beginning, Matt, like they've said this is going to be a law from the 1st of May, but they haven't really given more details around how they're going to implement it, legislate it, anything really. So I imagine the reason for that is because there's going to be a lot of backhanded deals to be done. Mm.
Sort of, looking outside of China for a moment, do you think this story raises any questions about the use of first-party data? Because obviously third-party has been under the spotlight for so long in Western markets with GDPR, etc. Do you think now first-party data and how that's being used will fall more under a spotlight? Or is it a case of it's a China-only problem at the moment, let's look at that later kind of thing?
Again, a good question. I think that because it's China, other countries will look at it as the Chinese government trying to control something that they want to have in their control. But I think actually there'll also be a lot of, I'm very cynical, obviously, when it comes to anything sort of data privacy related. Other countries will look at China potentially and go, they're taking their data privacy of their citizens really seriously. Maybe we should be doing the same thing. And obviously there are other countries globally that are doing such things, but it does raise a question, like, you know, what can companies ask for when they're asking for your personal information, and what do they logically need versus what they actually ask for, and should we as citizens be more fastidious in understanding what data we're giving away and why we're giving it away? You know, the argument around things like the Facetune app is a good example of that, where everyone just gave their faces away because the T's and C's weren't read and they said, we can use your face for whatever we like. It's our property now. And that's basically kind of what it said. I think there's a lot of that still going on, and maybe it will cause consumers to be more wary of it. I wonder at a country level, I'm not sure. Hopefully. Well, maybe not actually. It just becomes very complicated. I don't think China's doing it for the right reasons. So I wonder how it's going to be interpreted by different countries as well.
And I mean, I'm pretty cynical as well, Lindsay, but maybe trying to look at it through a different lens. It's the second largest economy in the world. You know, if people aren't doing business there, they're not open to figuring out how to do business there. Or if China are not making it easier to do business there, something's going wrong, forgetting about the relationship or even how the relationship perhaps is going to change now with Biden. But there's just huge opportunity. You're talking about 20.6 trillion or something in by 2024. That's huge amounts of money. And I genuinely feel that it's been overlooked.
As a market, definitely. Mm. Such opportunity, so many opportunities in that market. Yeah, 100%.
Awesome. I think that just brings us to the end of our time here. Lindsay, Anne-Marie, thank you both ever so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Matt.
And thank you all ever so much for listening.